You're listening to The Fuse Show, where wealth management and tech innovation converge. We break down the keys to success, as well as the technologies, mindsets, and solutions that will propel top advisors into the future. Here are your hosts, George Figuera and Ryan Donovan.
Welcome to The Fuse Show, a podcast brought to you by Orion with your hosts, Ryan Donovan and me, George Figuera. Today's guest is Colin Roche, founder and CIO of Global Macro ETF Discipline Funds and author of Pragmatic Capitalism. We're excited to have Colin with us today to share how he's constantly working towards helping people make smarter and more disciplined decisions with their money, including the impact trends like BeFi, AI, and FinTech have on the advisor and investor experience. Welcome to The Fuse Show, Colin.
Hey guys, it's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So we're so excited you could join us today. We can't wait to hear your thoughts on some of the latest in FinTech. Before we get started on Shop Talk, we'd like to have a little fun with you and get to know you a little better. So if you could, and I know this is a difficult one, I don't envy you. This is the hardest one. We've gone with food, I think, the previous times. But tell us, what's a no-skip album you'd recommend?
Oh my God. Why didn't I get the food question?
So much easier. I don't envy you. I don't know where this came from. Is a hot dog a sandwich was a good one. I'm interested in your opinion, but I think we have to stay on task here.
We're all kind of the same age. So you guys grew up probably doing the same thing I did, where I had like 10 albums in my car through basically all of, you know, grade school and high school. And you just played the same stuff on repeat. So most of my favorite albums were just greatest hits albums. But in terms of individual albums, I mean, my music taste, I think, is kind of like the way I almost approach portfolio management and a lot of things, in that I like to think I'm like voraciously open-minded. So I kind of grew up listening to just all sorts of different music. My go-to was always probably classic rock. So, I mean, I grew up listening to CCR, Creedence Clearwater, you know, on repeat, their greatest hits album. If I had to pick my favorite album, you know, no stop, probably Cosmos Factory. I mean, there's so many great songs on that that, you know, young people listening to this probably wouldn't even recognize. But if you heard them, you would instantly know what they are. And then, I mean, God, I listened to a ton of hip hop growing up. Bob Marley, I mean, his greatest hits is like, obviously, like, I, in my opinion, like the ultimate nonstop. You know, you can listen to every single song on one of those albums. So
I feel like a compilation of greatest hits is kind of cheating on this question, but
yeah, it sounds like you're describing Pandora or Apple Music.
I don't know. George, what would be yours? I think you came up with this question, so you probably have.
I did come up with this question, but you're right, Colin. Like, I don't know. Like, I can name a bunch of them. The one that comes to mind that I loved was Outkast, Stankonia, and that two-sided disc that they came out with. Remember? It was so good.
I got a double disc too, actually. Life After Death. That was a double disc, right? Yeah. That's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah. Yeah. I listened to that. That was in my CD player, my multi-disc CD player, like on repeat for probably over a year.
You remember the guy that had like the 9-disc changer in the trunk of his Acura? Yeah.
Yeah. Coolest guy ever. And a pair of JL Audio subwoofers.
Yeah. I had a tape player. So I remember back then, like when I would find, and I go through this weird thing where like I will listen to one song on repeat for like weeks on end. Like sometimes if I'm even in like exercising still in my old age, like I will find one song that I really like and I'll just play it nonstop for like an entire run or whatever. But
you know what that song is for me right now? Sundown by Gordon Lightfoot. Banger, dude.
But yeah, it was hilarious because back then, see, the kids don't know this, but back then I had a tape player in my old car, and in order to make this happen, I would listen to a song and then you had to hit rewind and wait.
Yep.
You had to wait like 2 minutes for it to rewind all the way back. And if you missed the starting point, I would memorize exactly how long it took to actually rewind to the beginning of this song. Because if you missed it, you go back into like halfway through the song in the previous one. You have to listen to the whole friggin' thing and then you get to your favorite song again. So
yeah. You know, what was funny, like they used to put the counter in the Walkman and it used to tell you how long something's been running. So it would help with that, like rewind. It never worked. It always was off. So, but yeah.
The things we've seen. The things we've seen, guys. So.
They'll never know. They'll never know how hard we had it.
Grandpa, why are you looking off into the near distance? Just thinking about the time when I had to rewind tapes to listen to music.
Right.
Yeah.
Seriously. Grandfather's like, I stormed the beaches at Normandy.
Yeah.
You're complaining about your tape player.
You had to rewind your life throwing copper.
Yeah, kids these days will never know why there was always a pencil next to the tape player. It's the manual recording.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so, I mean, let me help us get back on track here, if there is such a thing. So, since we went way back with you, Colin, can you maybe take us back a little bit? Tell us a little bit more about Discipline Funds. You know, you founded Discipline Funds to help investors build common sense portfolios consistent with their personal financial planning needs and, you know, their risk tolerance. That resonates really well to what we do here at Orion. If you could really walk us through your philosophy on why investors are looking for that more these days, and that'd be helpful.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the big things that I've struggled with, and, you know, my background is economics and finance. So I kind of traversed both of these worlds in a weird way. And have done a lot of work on, I mean, a lot of people who probably know about me know about a lot of my work in macroeconomics. And so it's interesting coming into the financial world with a lot of a macroecon background and understanding things from really more of sort of a first principles perspective, where a lot of my work has been built on developing a framework for understanding the world for what it is, rather than so much of what we do in finance and even economics, we try to think of the world in terms of the way people kind of want it to be. And so I tried to build this sort of framework for understanding the world from, you know, sort of an operational reality perspective. And I think one of the most interesting things that I learned when I was studying economics is that the word investing is misused in the financial world almost by everybody. So in economics, investing is spending for future production. And that's, I think, really important to understand in the context of what we call investing, because what most of us are doing when we buy stocks and bonds is not actually investing. We are reallocating our savings. We really don't have very much control over the way that the instruments we buy generate their returns. And this is the crucial distinction in economics, is that when a firm spends for investment, they have some control over the way that that generates a return on investment, meaning that the firm is actually choosing. When they spend for investment, they're literally, you know, buying things like building a factory or trying to generate, you know, new innovations and investing the actual money in that. When they spend money on those things, those are actual investments, whereas the rest of us are just allocating our savings into instruments that generate returns based on how well the firms actually invest. And that was sort of eye-opening for me, especially in the context of all this, because you sort of realize that we sometimes think of investing as this sort of sexy get-rich-quick endeavor. And the reality is that a lot of it is just, or most of it is just reallocating our savings. And it's this very prudent sort of approach to, I think, you know, diversifying our savings across different instruments in a way where what a lot of us are doing has nothing to do with getting rich quick. The getting rich quick, if it happens, and it's usually getting rich slow, is the investments we make in ourselves. And we generate an income based on the investments that we make. So, you know, improving our skills, or if we are entrepreneurs, we're building, you know, new innovations or things that will generate a return on investment, we're earning an income, which we then retain some as savings. And then we reallocate those savings into instruments to diversify and protect our savings in essence. And so I think a lot of people come into this where they think the stock market is somewhere where you're going to get rich. And in most cases, the stock market and the financial markets in general are a place where you allocate your savings to meet certain financial goals. It's not a place where you get rich. You're going to get rich generally from, you know, building your own skills and generating an income from that. And then the stock and bond markets are where you can diversify and protect your wealth from things like inflation and instability and whatnot. But it's a more prudent process. And so for me, coming at it with that framework was really important, because I think it helped me kind of put things in the right perspective, where I realized, oh, the real investments I make are in myself and in my firm and in the technologies we'll build. And then the savings we generate from that are really more sort of protective and to be allocated in a way that are designed to meet very specific goals. So in terms of the way we really approach the investment world, I mean, I've, especially after having kids, I realized that, you know, I'm a big behavioralist. So I come at the economic side, not just from an operational perspective, but understanding that, you know, there's people involved in all this and there's emotions involved in this. And so behavioral finance is incredibly important to understand in terms of helping yourself navigate all of this so that you can understand your own biases. And I think that time is this really the crucial aspect in all of this, because time is the thing that creates all of the uncertainty. And I think, especially for retail investors, I think we have a lot of trouble understanding the time horizons of our, not just our expenses over time and our future liabilities, but especially the assets that then match relative to those liabilities. And so my framework is very similar to the way that a lot of pensions and insurance companies and even banks manage their portfolios by applying what's called an asset liability matching approach. And so what I do is I call it defined duration investing. What I essentially did was I modeled a way to actually quantify the time horizons of specific instruments. So for instance, the stock market is a 17-year instrument in our model. The aggregate bond market is a 5-year instrument. A treasury bill is essentially a zero duration instrument. And so what we do is we work from a financial planning foundation where we are calculating someone's liabilities over time and their expenses, and then we're matching assets with it. And the main goal of this is not just to create what I think is a better framework for helping people navigate their financial plan, but also helping people better understand the time horizons over which their assets correspond with their expenses and their future liabilities. And what this is really designed to do is help people stay the course. So I'm a big advocate of everything that John Bogle ever, you know, really said, and staying the course is the hardest part. And I think that the thing that knocks people off course primarily is that they don't know the time horizons of things like, what is the time horizon of the stock market? And in the short term, the stock market does a lot of crazy stuff. And when you don't understand the time horizon of instruments, you can't stay the course because you have so much uncertainty over your ability to manage your liabilities that you end up getting knocked off course because you want more certainty. And that's why when people sell stocks in a panic, what they're really doing is they're buying certainty. They're buying cash because they know that cash gives them certainty of time horizons. And that's one of the biggest behavioral hurdles. So we're trying to build technology and approaches that are helping people stay the course, build better financial plans, and better match their behavior to a portfolio that will help them achieve their financial goals.
Colin, that I regularly send the Michael Scott gif of explain this to me like I'm five, if you know what I'm referring to.
He actually sent it to me earlier today.
I sent it to him earlier. So I'm curious, how did you define the stock market as a 17-year duration and bonds as a 5-year duration? It's like, what does that mean, one? And like, could you give us like almost like a real-world example of, I have a client and this is where they're at in their life, and then this is how that's applicable to whatever they're trying to achieve, right? Like if they're 20 years out from retirement, for example, or something like that.
Yeah. So this was the hard part. So, you know, duration is a concept that's usually applied to bonds. And what it really explains is the sensitivity to interest rate changes. And so it gives bond investors a way of understanding the time horizons over which they're likely to experience a certain amount of principal volatility. And this concept has been, a lot of people have tried to apply it to the stock market using either dividends or some sort of interest rate function. I used an approach that's similar to what William Bernstein talks about in the past, where he defines duration as point of indifference. And this is essentially a break even. So if you, for instance, if you take the max drawdown of the stock market and you assume some sort of real expected future return, you can calculate what the break even point is. And to me, the break-even point is the true point of indifference. This is the point where, in real terms, you're indifferent to the instrument and its returns over a certain time period. And the stock market, we quantified it as about a 17-year instrument. So if you assume the max drawdowns are 55% or so, the real returns are something like 4.5%. it takes about 17 years for that instrument to break even. So you're kind of using almost like a worst case scenario analysis. But the interesting thing with this framework is that all the bond figures roughly correlate to almost exactly what traditional duration calculations also were. And so, you know, the sensitivity of the bond market in the aggregate is much lower than the stock market, obviously, because typically the principal volatility is just much lower. So your break even isn't as long.
What do you mean by break even? Like, break even to me is like, I get back what I put in.
Yeah, exactly. So it's essentially the point of indifference for the investor, where you put in $100, if it falls to $45, how long does it take for you to get back to 100 in real terms? So inflation adjusted. That's your point of indifference, essentially. So if you were to buy the stock market today and it was to fall 55%, how long would it take you to break even on that instrument, essentially? Obviously, these numbers they're rough to some degree. But the big takeaway, especially for the stock market, is that the stock market should be best thought of as a multi-decade instrument. It is inherently a long-term instrument. So, you know, 17 years might be too long. It's roughly correct in the sense that it's a long-term instrument. You know, the duration of the stock market might be a little lower than that, but it might be a little longer than that, depending on, you know, certain environments. But the big takeaway is that it's a long-term instrument. So in terms of applying this sort of approach for people in a practical sense, well, I mean, typically what we do is, I found that working with clients, the really crucial aspect here is to get the short-term stuff right. If you get the short-term stuff right, the longer-term stuff sort of takes care of itself for the most part, in the sense that you're freeing up a lot of behavioral bandwidth to give people the comfort level to be a lot more aggressive with instruments that are inherently long-term. So for instance, if you had a client with $100,000, and let's say that let's use bigger numbers just to make this simpler. Let's just say somebody has $1 million and they spend roughly $50,000 a year, and they want to put $200,000 on a home down payment in the next, say, 3 to 5 years. The time horizon's a little uncertain. That investor could go out and, using just sort of, you know, generalized financial planning frameworks of, say, like, put 2 years of money aside for emergency funds and, you know, just a backstop for a couple of years of expenditures, and then bucketing your home down payment into another bucket, you can start from the short end of the duration curve there and basically go out and buy, say, 2 years worth of, so $100,000 worth of, say, treasury bills. And you bucket that however you need it across a specific time horizon for treasury bills. And then within that home down payment bucket, say you're putting 200 grand into intermediate bonds. So something that's going to be very safe over, say, a 3 to 5 year time horizon, but a little longer than the treasury bills. So hopefully earns a little higher than the treasury bills, but is also corresponding to this time horizon wherein you might need it. So you're bucketing things out, and then all the rest is probably retirement goals or maybe kids' tuition. It's longer term money. You could put all the rest into equity and long duration style instruments, where those are likely to generate better returns than the bonds, and they correspond to much longer duration time horizon. So, you know, you could make this as sophisticated as you want. You can use as many time horizons as you want. But the real goal is to create a lot of front-loaded certainty for the investor, so that regardless of what's happening with the long duration stuff, they can always look at the short duration stuff and say, okay, yeah, the stock market is down 30% this year, but I know that's a multi-decade instrument, and I don't care what it's doing in the short term, because look, I've got $100,000 or $200,000 of short-term instruments that are keeping me sane when everything looks insane. Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense. So I think, you know, what we see a lot of is people looking at the risk of their client's portfolio and trying to balance the diversification of asset classes mm-hmm. to the identified risk. And admittedly, I don't have very many people looking at the different cash flow, you know, life events, which, if I understand you correctly, the client has, retirement being a significant one, but maybe others yeah. along the way, and matching the portfolio's duration to that. And so I guess, you know, what I'm curious with is in the, you know, product packaging of a mutual fund, how specific do these allocations get for the individual investor's needs, which could be, you know, drastically different.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. You could make this very, very, you can make this overly complex. I try to always sort of defer towards keeping it simple. But the reason I kind of developed this framework was because, and most people do this in finance, we start with sort of a modern portfolio theory approach to portfolio allocation. And we try to build the portfolio that's going to generate basically the best risk-adjusted returns. And you take a general risk profile, you diversify, you build something like, say, a 60-40 portfolio, and you say, you kind of know this is going to generate an optimal risk-adjusted return over, you know, certain time periods based on your risk profile. And the problem with that is that I've consistently run into the fact that that 60-40 portfolio, people don't really know what the time horizon of that instrument is. Yeah. And more importantly, a lot of 60-40s, especially, like, you, let's use something really simple, like a Boglehead three fund portfolio, where you've got a domestic international stock allocation, and then your third fund is an aggregate bond fund. Well, that allocation roughly fits, you know, this sort of modern portfolio theory, most efficient type of portfolio approach. The problem is, from a financial planning perspective, you don't have a lot of liquidity in that portfolio. So, you know, for instance, last year, the bond aggregate is down, what, 15%, something like that? If an investor needed liquidity last year, they didn't have it in that portfolio. They needed another bucket. They needed a short-term bucket. And the crazy thing, or the interesting thing with, like, even a bond aggregate, is that your aggregate bond fund actually holds a lot of cash, but the investor doesn't have access to actually get the liquidity inside of that portfolio, because when they want to sell it, they have to sell the entire fund. So you're not only selling your short duration instruments, you're also selling your long duration instruments. This is even more exaggerated in something like a target date fund or something, where, you know, I generally think target date funds are great, except for the fact that if you need liquidity inside of a target date fund, when you need to sell some part of that to get access to the cash, and the cash is the part you want, you have to sell some part of everything in it. So you're not only selling the cash portion, you're selling the stocks inside of it, you're selling the bonds. And this is a problem because in a lot of cases, people most need cash typically when the stock market is down a lot. There's, you know, for some reason, something traumatic is going on in the economy, or, you know, your work life or whatever, and the stock market is down, and you want access to cash because you need it. But if you have a fund like a target date fund or even a 60-40 fund, if you need to get that cash, you've got to sell your stocks low, which is exactly the wrong way to actually be managing your finances, especially from a behavioral finance perspective. So, you know, this sort of defined duration approach, it actually breaks out the components across these specific buckets, where if you need liquidity, the liquidity is right there. It's right there in your T-bill bucket or whatever your short-term bucket is. And you can go in and you can liquidate that thing or transfer it or whatever. And you can roughly build out, you know, the same 60-40 style allocation. But because you've broken out the cash based on a specific time horizon, you have access to it, rather than, you know, you could almost argue that target date funds and even a three fund approach is, it's like too simple. You know, it's beautiful in a lot of ways in that it's diversified and low fee and all that good stuff. But it's almost too simple in the sense that it doesn't actually give the investor the liquidity they need when they need it.
How does disciplined funds then solve for that, Colin? Like, looking at your website, are there different funds that are used together? Are these strategies? Like, there's just general restrictions with mutual funds, given my limited understanding of the investment world. So I'm just curious, how do you guys do that?
Well, so we customize. I mean, most of our portfolios are separately managed accounts, where we're actually, okay, we're customizing all of this. Our own funds designed basically to, we only have one ETF right now. This is something that in the long run, we hope to actually develop a framework that has a lot more funds, where we can then apply this sort of an approach to help people really basically build simple portfolios, but match them across very specific time horizons. Mm-hmm. Whereas right now, with the one fund that we have, it's essentially a 10-year instrument inside of our model. And so the fund that we build now is sort of a core, very tax efficient fund that is designed to be sort of a 10-year instrument that, it's a blend of stocks and bonds. And so it's not really a stock instrument. It's not long duration. It's not really a bond instrument either. It's not short duration. So it's sort of this intermediate blend that's designed to sort of fill a kind of a 5 to 15 year time horizon for people, and just do so in a very diversified, tax efficient manner. But ideally, yeah, I mean, assuming, you know, we can develop the technology and build more of these ETFs in the future, we would like to build a really systematic approach to developing an ETF line that helps people then be able to access this sort of defined duration approach across very specific time horizons, where they've got a systematic portfolio that, especially from a financial planning perspective, they can look at the funds and say, okay, this is my 5-year time horizon, this is my 10-year time horizon, this is my 20-year time horizon, and just plug and play. And the whole thing is systematic, low fee, ultra diversified. I mean, the secret sauce of ETFs is tax efficiency. That's the biggie with a lot of ETFs, especially multi-asset ETFs. A lot of people don't know that multi-asset ETFs rebalance in a very, very tax efficient way, where you can avoid a lot of long-term capital gains because you've basically compartmentalize them all inside of one ETF that rebalances over time, but doesn't kick off capital gains distributions.
So advisors a lot of times will focus on risk-adjusted returns with their clients. We're big proponents of BFI here at Orion, as you might know. And so we'd love your insights into how behavioral finance impacts your client conversation. It sounds like there's going to be a significant amount of training to understand your philosophy when you have so many other voices with differing views. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, how the behavioral finance impacts the decisions of investors and how you use that in your firm?
So I published this paper, I think it was 18 months ago. It's called Defined Duration Investing. And this is, it kind of outlines the framework that I've built here for implementing this. And so for the last 18 months, we've been implementing this in real time and getting real time feedback. And I think it's shockingly intuitive to people, in the sense that when you explain to them that you're really trying to create certainty of time across your financial plan, people, I think, just get that. And I actually think a lot of financial planners really find this is pretty similar to like a bucketing approach. Mm-hmm. And I think the bucketing approach is very intuitively appealing to financial planners, because it's so easy to then communicate the concepts to clients and keep their interests aligned. Whereas, I mean, for years and years, I was implementing this sort of mean variance optimization approach with modern portfolio theory and implementing what is essentially like a 60-40 portfolio. And you consistently run into people who, you'll bring in a client in 2019, and then 2020 happens, the stock market falls a lot, and they feel like your plan is failing them. And it's like, well, wait a minute, you know, we've only been at this for 1 year. Like, where did this go wrong? And why are you, you know, feeling so, you know, disturbed by the portfolio returns? We built a long-term financial plan here. And it's in large part because we haven't actually created certainty across specific time horizons for the client. And this solves a lot of those problems, because especially when you work from that short-term, you know, end of the duration curve, you can create so much certainty for people that I think they just sort of intuitively feel a lot more comfortable with this. And it frees up so much behavioral bandwidth to actually be more aggressive with the longer term stuff, that I think it's easy for especially a financial planner, not only to plan around this, but also to communicate it to people, where, you know, when you say, hey, the stock market is a 17-year instrument, yeah, that might be, you know, only precisely correct. But the point is, you know, hey, the stock market was down 30% last year. Who cares? It doesn't matter, because we've actually segmented all this other stuff out in your portfolio, where behaviorally, you shouldn't care what the stock market does inside of a 1 year period, because we know that we structured your portfolio in a way where it is inherently long term. It's filling a long term bucket, and we just, you know, set it and forget it, ignore it. We hope that it can fund your short term portion of your portfolio in the long run, but it doesn't need to, because we've also bucketed that short term component out for you. So I think from a behavioral finance perspective, it's really just giving people greater clarity about the time horizons of specific instruments and the role they're playing, so that people have a better understanding of, hey, you know, what is the time horizon of all these instruments?
So, you know, obviously Donnie and I are talking to advisors about technology and client experiences and reporting and all that stuff every day. And, you know, our protect, live, dream asset bucketing component of our client experience is something where I actually have my demo environment to land on that to show, here's your short term, here's your moderate term, here's your longer term assets. Do you provide, or how can advisors, you know, present this to a client where they can see that and they can experience that? Like, one thing that used to drive me nuts talking to advisors is, like, I tell my clients, don't look at your accounts, don't watch CNBC, don't do this, don't do that. And I always thought, well, that makes me want to do it now as a client. But, like, what you're saying to me, the way I'm taking it, is if you can frame it in a way where they have an understanding of what those assets in that instrument are for, they can look at it every day and go, that kind of sucks, but I know that this is longer term, or I know there's now some tax loss harvest opportunities with that down market, or whatever that may be. You can kind of change the frame of reference for that information they take it in. So I'm just curious, what are some tools that you've seen that help advisors do that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, well, this approach isn't really used by retail investors. I mean, I know a lot of advisors that implement some version of, like, a bucketing approach, but off the top of my head, I can't think of anything that's really, like, formalized this, and especially not in a tech package. So, you know, who knows? Maybe this should be on Orion's plate for the future. But, you know, for me, you know, we're still so early in developing this that a lot of this is trying to structure. The way that I structure it typically is across specific accounts. So typically, like, you know, like, one thing that I ran into was, like, with financial planning, a lot of people talk about tax location, and I've become convinced that tax location is actually, it can be incredibly detrimental to the way people think about this, because a lot of people will say, oh, like, look at your bonds are tax inefficient. So you want to put your bonds into tax deferred accounts. So people might end up putting their bonds in their retirement accounts. Whereas for me, inside of this framework, it's the opposite. Your taxable account is almost always going to be where you need to pull liquidity from, unless you're very old and you're pulling RMDs, a huge amounts of RMDs or something. But for most people, your taxable account is where you need liquidity. It's where your bonds, you know, regardless of tax effects, I mean, we should always try to optimize for taxes. But, you know, in terms of, you know, a hierarchy of needs, liquidity always is always more important than tax planning. And so your bonds almost by necessity need to be in your taxable account, whereas your retirement accounts are almost always inherently long-term. In a lot of cases, in fact, most cases that I work with, your retirement accounts end up being multi-generational to some degree. So they're not even just long-term for you, they're long-term for somebody else, which means they're ultra long-term. And so from a financial planning perspective, you can almost think of, like, your Roth and traditional IRAs or whatever as really your long-term buckets, and your taxable account is typically where you're going to be pulling liquidity from. And so we're very, very hands-on with cash. I mean, I'm rolling millions of dollars of T-bills almost every day now. And so we're very hands-on with the taxable accounts, in a sense where when we structure these things, we try to really communicate to clients that, okay, your taxable money is where we're pulling money from, you're taking monthly withdrawals from, and that's where we need liquidity. So we're structuring this thing in a very specific temporal sense where clients can look at their taxable account and sort of know, okay, this is structured for liquidity. Yeah, it may hold some equities based on the needs, but it's mostly a liquidity account for most practical purposes. And your retirement accounts are typically much, much more aggressive because they're long duration, long equity type of instruments that you probably won't tap for, you know, many decades or a relatively long time. And you can change that over time as you kind of near retirement, where, you know, especially if you're taking RMDs, you need a more liquid instrument than the equity market. But for the most part, we're structuring these right now across accounts to communicate to the client. And it's interesting, with a lot of clients, I actually tell them, because you can, in Schwab and other custodians, you can actually change the title of your account. I'll actually tell clients to change the title of the account to a specific time horizon so that when they click on their taxable account, they'll see the target for this account is, say, a five-year average duration. So in their mind, they're looking at that account and they kind of know, okay, this is the time horizon of this account. And compared to my Roth, which is down 2% today, that says 15 years. And so they're totally different time horizons based on the way the client is actually looking and experiencing the portfolio, rather than, you know, the way it is now, like people just turn on CNBC and they see the stock market doing crazy stuff and they say, I don't know the time horizon of this thing. And my portfolio is down 1% in total. And I have no idea how I'm supposed to actually compartmentalize any of this stuff. And I'm scared. And so I need to create liquidity. And so I'm going to sell some part of my stocks. Whereas, you know, looking at it through this like more defined duration approach, you kind of know where your liquidity is and you kind of know what not to sell because you kind of know the time horizons more specifically.
You know, sometimes I don't know if I like doing this podcast because I don't think my financial plan of working and saving as much as I can until I wake up one day and go, I don't want to do this anymore, is comprehensive enough.
I just have a lot of life insurance and I plan to die.
Yeah. I'm just going to work until I heal over. Yeah.
Well, hey, life insurance is actually a great example of like a defined duration instrument because a life insurance instrument is actually, it's an ultra, ultra long-term instrument that's designed to generate a negative real return, except in certain cases where if you die, it generates a huge asymmetric positive return in the short term. And so, you know, insurance is a very, very prudent part of a financial plan where, you know, it's your insurance bucket. So it's like this whole other bucket that we haven't even touched on yet that, you know, and you can debate the needs for insurance inside of a portfolio. I have these debates with people all the time about whether we should hold things like managed futures or gold or, you know, options. And those things are all in my framework. They're all basically insurance instruments. Okay. So they fit this whole other bucket where they can insure certain instruments. But from a basic financial planning perspective, life insurance, for instance, is just a very practical instrument because it's a long duration instrument that has a potential asymmetric payoff in bad scenarios.
You've kind of really messed with my perception of investing with the first thing. Like I'm thinking of the first time any of these investment instruments were ever pitched to someone. Like, here's what I want you to do. I want you to give me $100 every month. And if you die, I'll give you a ton of money. And the person being like, you want me to give you money so that you can pay me money if I die? I don't want to. Or like, give me money and we're going to buy gold. Can I see the gold? Yeah. Nah, you can't see it. Does the gold exist? Probably not. Just give me the money. It's in gold.
Well, it's crazy, you know, kind of going back to like that whole first principles perspective. Like I laugh when I look at things like options exchanges or like futures exchanges, because the reason that these things actually began to exist was mainly because like futures were created so that farmers basically could like, they could hedge their exposure to hog, you know, or like, you know, meats or, you know, oil, like airlines like to buy oil futures to hedge their exposure to the oil price, you know, and it's an insurance policy. You're literally buying this thing to insure against some sort of change in price in the underlying instrument. And it's weird now the way that the financial services industry and especially the investment business has matured. Maybe matured is the wrong word, but devolved maybe. We now sell a lot of these instruments as like part of like a broader package where we don't actually sell them as insurance. We sell them as like, as if they're the same thing as buying a stock or a bond, which to me, it's like completely backwards. The insurance is not the profit generating instrument. It's a protective instrument that protects you from, you know, the changes in the underlying asset class. But, you know, now, I mean, there's just so many different funds and strategies that are, you know, options writing strategies or managed future strategies. And to me, you know, I'm not knocking these things. They may be perfectly appropriate for certain people, but I don't think they're appropriately thought of as like the core of a portfolio, the cash flow generating instruments in a portfolio. There's something totally different. They're really more like buying the life insurance. They're not the core asset of a portfolio.
Yeah, no, I agree. So I guess getting it back again on track, I'm trying my best here. This is insightful stuff. This is a lot to communicate to your clients. And like you said, you know, you have to have conversations sometimes with clients about the longevity of their portfolio and keeping their eyes on the bigger picture. How do you see technology helping as it relates to the client communication and the implementation and the reevaluation of their plan?
I mean, it's a great, great time to be especially a retail investor because you're getting access to so many technologies that especially from a portfolio management perspective are just simplifying things and making everything much more systematic. So I look forward to a world where everything is just much more systematic. We're obviously big believers in ETFs. I think the ETF world is its own sort of unique little tech component of the fintech world, where ETFs are incredibly, incredibly efficient and, you know, incredibly simple but sophisticated products that allow people to build, you know, really a tech-based implementation of their portfolio using a much more, I think, efficient process than, say, mutual funds or even direct indexing or especially stock picking, I think. So, you know, that's for us, obviously, the big focus is on the ETF technology, and but really building things that are more systematic. I mean, we're, in terms of our portfolio management style, like we're very, very hands off. I mean, all of our portfolio management processes are basically algorithm driven. So, you know, data in, data out. It's not Cullen saying, hey, what is the Federal Reserve doing today? It's me looking at data outputs and just, you know, that's how the portfolios change based on that. And that, I think, helps people build a more systematic approach to managing their portfolio where you're not letting yourself get in the way of the process along the way. So, you know, but even little things, I mean, the technology is so great, you know, we're not currently an Orion user, but we're going to be here very shortly. I think we talked about that briefly before, but, you know, the whole platform, just the way it's designed to simplify things, communicate things better to clients, and then, you know, really make things much more automatic and systematic is incredibly, incredibly useful for people because it just helps keep the behavior out of all of it. So I look forward to the technology developing more systematic sort of approaches that will help people stay the course and, you know, stay more disciplined to a financial plan that they're building. Because that's the core of all this, is that all of this should be really financial planning based.
Sure. And that's the tough thing. It's always been, right? Personalization at scale. And that's where I think there's the intersection between what you're doing and what we're doing here at Orion. Mm-hmm. But I guess in terms of this, you know, we kind of ask our guests to look into the crystal ball. This is a kind of an ominous time with, you know, geopolitical turmoil, stubbornly high, you know, inflation, sustained interest rates that are quite high. So we're approaching the end of the year, and I'm curious, Cullen, what do you see when you look in your crystal ball in trends that are going to be taking place in 2024?
Well, gosh, in terms of geopolitical trends?
No, we'll be more specific. More specific. Looking into your algorithms, which are your crystal ball, I mean, how do you see yourself having to prepare clients for what lies ahead in their portfolios?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things I'm actually very excited for, especially in the fintech space, is consolidation. I think that the last sort of 5 to 10 years have been this very, I think, early developmental phase with a lot of fintech, where a lot of different technologies have come online, and it's very fragmented. I mean, as an advisor, like, I struggle with, do I need a dedicated rebalancing program and a dedicated cash management program and a dedicated CRM and there's all these different things that are, you know, we're trying to integrate into our businesses. And I love what you guys are doing because you're kind of the leader, I think, in terms of consolidating a lot of this into a nice, clean, neat package. And I look forward to that happening more and more so, where not only are ETFs and underlying investment products more integrated into the whole process, but the whole financial planning package is kind of crammed down into more of a one-stop shop, where we don't have this sort of fragmentation of all these different very useful technologies that people are trying to kind of cobble together. And so, yeah, I think the next 5 to 10 years are going to be a big, big period of more consolidation. I'm sure there'll be a lot more technology that's developed along the way, but I look forward to a lot of the consolidation that's going to happen, where more and more of these sort of fintech startups become, you know, really much more mature, developed companies that are then helping people integrate a much more comprehensive package that, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of the big broker dealers and the custodians right now, they're just not doing it very well. And so, you know, a lot of these smaller sort of, you know, startup companies, they're beating the door down on these guys and they're forcing them to either change or they're going to steal their lunch. And so, You know, I look forward to all that consolidation and, you know, making it simpler for the financial advisors to actually help their clients integrate all this rather than dealing with, you know, five or six different technologies that are kind of all fragmented.
Excellent. Well, Colin, I appreciate you coming on to the Fuse Show and speaking with George and I today. And I guess in terms of your funds, your philosophy, tell us a little bit for our listeners where they'd be able to find more information about you.
Yeah, so I write a lot at disciplinefunds.com. It's we have a newsletter called Discipline Alerts, and you know, we write about not just a lot of the sort of macroeconomic goings on, but we talk about more financial planning based concepts and even just understanding the essential components of like portfolio construction so that people can, you know, I think the goal here is to understand the world for what it is and understand things in a way that helps us stay the course and stay more behaviorally robust to everything that's going on. Cause there's so much garbage out there. There's so much, you know, fear mongering and so much uncertainty that people need certainty, especially in these sorts of times. And we like to think that we're helping people better understand the world for what it is so that they can build better financial plans and better portfolios that'll help them achieve their financial goals.
Excellent.
That's great.
Thanks for coming on today, Colin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. And a hot dog is not a sandwich.
I would tend to agree nowadays.
Yep. He's right.
Cool. We settled it.
Argument over. Thank you. All right. Thanks for listening to The Fuse Show. In each episode, your co-host, George Figuera, and me, Ryan Donovan, will share our top take on fintech news, welcome industry leaders and colleagues to share their perspectives and keep you up to date on all that's happening at Orion. We are committed to help advisors in their ability to leverage the fiduciary flywheel to prospect, plan, invest, and achieve for their firm. Feel free to share your thoughts on the show with us and send us questions to cover in future episodes. Just shoot us an email at thefuseshow@orion.com.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Fuse Show. This podcast is brought to you by Orion and produced by Turncast. You can subscribe to future episodes in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information about Orion and The Fuse Show, visit us at orion.com.